What is up, Iwu crew? Criminal cases can often have surprising twists and turns, and today we are taking a look at a few cases that are particularly shocking, and so strange that they may not seem real. But we promise they are all true. The first case we have today is a mix of fact and fiction, and it is a story full of bizarre twists. In 2003, on June 29th, two boys, 14-year-old John and 16-year-old Mark, walked together through an alleyway called Goose Green in the small town of Altrincham, England. Neither of those names are real, as both are aliases given to the boys to keep their true identities a secret. While passing through Goose Green, John was attacked. He was viciously stabbed once in the stomach and another time in the chest. Around 20 minutes after the incident, Mark called for an ambulance, saying that a madman had attacked his friend. Mark described the attacker as being in his early 20s and dressed in a black hoodie and black jeans. Soon people were on the lookout for a knife-wielding madman in the area. John was rushed to the Withenshaw Hospital, where he had to have his gallbladder removed after one of the stab wounds had pierced both his kidney and liver. While being operated on, John almost died on two occasions. Blood built up in his chest and resulted in him requiring a respirator to breathe. But despite the odds, John survived the attack. The seemingly unprovoked stabbing shocked the public, as the area was known to be quiet and peaceful with a low crime rate, but the case would soon turn out to be even more shocking. Police quickly realized that Mark had been lying about the attacker. The area where he said the stabber ran off ended in a 40-foot drop, and after reviewing a closed-circuit camera, police never found evidence of anyone but the two boys entering the alleyway. Mark was arrested for attempted murder, and after giving the police multiple different stories, John would finally admit that his friend had been the one to stab him. John told the police, "Mark did it once, stood up, holding me, did it again. He was kneeling on me saying, 'Trust me,' holding the knife to my stomach." John says he screamed, "Call an ambulance, I'm dying." To which Mark responded, "Shush, people will hear, please be quiet." John says he then cried, "You've killed me." And Mark replied, "Don't say that. Don't let that be the last thing you are saying." Mark's arrest, though a surprise, wasn't the end of this case. Another arrest was made 4 months after the stabbing, and this time John was also arrested, charged with inciting murder. The murder John had planned was his own. Months prior to the attack, John had spent hours on chat forums crafting half a dozen different identities and building captivating stories around each. It was through these characters that he talked to Mark. Mark reportedly had no idea that all of the different people he spoke to through chat rooms were all actually John, using different names and emails, even changing some of the ways each fake person spoke over the chats. John had initially befriended Mark through his first fake character named Rachel West, who claimed that the real John was her brother. Through ongoing conversations, Mark developed a crush on the girl he only knew through chat rooms, and with her urging, became friends with her brother in real life. With the six chat room characters, John built a shocking world where Mark was dating Rachel, where there were kidnappers, murderers, and secret agents, and Mark was part of it all. Though the world was only discussed through chat rooms, Mark believed it and was wrapped up in a world that was part real, part fiction, all masterminded by John and his six characters. John made sure to mention real people in Mark's life, bringing in an element of the real world to make his ruse all the more immersive and convincing. 16-year-old Mark was particularly gullible to be pulled in so easily by John's lies. But a judge commenting on the case chillingly remarked that skilled writers of fiction would struggle to conjure up a plot such as arises here. Mark endlessly communicated with John's characters, so much so that during the investigation, police had to go over 133 gigabytes of data, and 58,000 lines of text were taken in as evidence for the case, which was only a small fraction of all the messages Mark exchanged with John's six personas. John later shared that fooling his friend so easily was, quote, like feeding a dog. It is reported that John worked tirelessly on fueling this dark fabrication, often nurturing his made-up world from 4 p.m. to 7 in the morning, later explaining, I'd stopped eating in March, just wanted to be on the internet, that's all that mattered. It was through John's persona of a British agent named Janet Dobinson that he convinced Mark to kill him. This character told Mark that everyone around him was a possible secret agent working for the British government, and that he had been selected to possibly join their ranks. He only had to prove himself worthy. The best way to do this was to kill John. Janet told Mark the implausible and far-fetched story that John was dying from a terminal brain tumor, but that the British Secret Service needed him dead earlier because he was worth £568 billion, which he kept in a huge, massive safe containing the world's richest jewels. John had to die in order to keep all of the treasure safe, and Mark was quickly convinced, though he had to be reassured by the secret agent that it wasn't murder for him to kill John. You want me to kill him? That's what you're asking me. Mark wrote to Janet over their chat. And just leave him to die. What should I say to him? Stand there a minute while I stab you? You love him, John responded as Janet in the chat, masterminding his own death and telling his friend to be the one to do it. It didn't take much convincing beyond that, and when it came to the day of the incident, Mark said to John, I love you, bro, just before stabbing him twice. John was an isolated and depressed teen in desperate need of attention. He felt trapped by the internet world he had created and couldn't imagine any other way to escape. Some investigators concluded that John had chosen to plan his own murder and cast Mark as his killer out of fear and a desperation to take his own life, while others see him only as downright wicked and evil for manipulating another person so successfully. It is also believed that John targeted Mark for his deception because he was attracted to him and believed that he was out of his league. Initially, John had used the fake person Rachel as a way to talk to Mark, but everything spiraled out of control from there. Though the case itself is so strange it doesn't seem real, there is one more bizarre aspect. Over the chats, Mark had seemed convinced by the supposed secret agent Janet that he would be released for killing John. Yet when he was brought in for the crime, he never once asked for her, nor told anyone about the government conspiracy that had convinced him to kill his friend, even though he should have believed it would free him. Instead, when he confessed to the stabbing, he told police that he heard voices telling him to do it, leaving many to wonder just how much of the fantasy that John created did Mark actually believe. Even John thinks that Mark knew the characters weren't real. This conclusion brings some credence to the theory that both wanted to end the lies between them, and Mark was willing to kill John to make it stop. Both boys pleaded guilty to their charges, and John is likely one of the first people in the world to be convicted of inciting their own murder. This next case is no less dramatic than the Goose Green stabbing, but has even more dire consequences. Living in Fayetteville, North Carolina in 1985, the Eastburns were a military family. Captain Gary Eastburn was part of the Air Force and had moved his family to Pope Air Force Base so that he could work as the chief of air traffic control. Gary's wife, Katie, was more than happy to move where her husband needed to go and happily brought along the couple's three children, 5-year-old Kara, 3-year-old Aaron, and 22-month-old Jana. In May 1985, the family decided they needed a change and that they would relocate to England so that Gary could work as a liaison with the Royal Air Force. Gary was away in Montgomery, Alabama for training at a squadron's officer school during much of the packing and planning for the move, and so Katie took over most of the responsibilities. She realized that the family wouldn't be able to take their English setter Dixie with them for the trip, so she posted an ad in the local paper for someone to come take Dixie. On May 7th, 27-year-old Army Sergeant Timothy Hennis called about the ad and came to visit the Eastburn house to see Dixie. Timothy said that he and his wife owned a Spitz and that with their newborn daughter, it was the perfect time to add another dog to his family. And so he took Dixie with him. On May 11th, Gary became concerned when Katie didn't answer any of his calls, but concluded that she must have been busy with the move and their kids. However, the Eastburn's neighbor was also worried and soon called the police when he hadn't seen the family in a while. Police found Katie's body inside the house next to the bed, along with those of her two oldest children. "Death has a smell, its own aroma. I'll never forget the smell in there," one detective later said. Katie had been assaulted, stabbed 15 times, and her throat cut, while Kara was also stabbed and Aaron bludgeoned in the chest and back. Jana was left unscathed by the attacker, but was severely dehydrated by the time she was found. It was determined that Katie and her daughters had been killed the night of May 9th and early morning of May 10th. Investigators found evidence of both fingerprints and hair, and this, along with a luminol test, revealed that the killer had poorly attempted to clean the crime scene. Devastated by the loss, Gary returned to his home in an effort to aid investigators. He determined that cash and Katie's ATM card had been stolen, along with a slip of paper where she had written her PIN number. Witnesses came forward to say that they had seen someone enter the Eastburn house the night Katie and her daughters were killed. The person was described as being a tall white man, wearing a knit cap and a black jacket that had "Members Only" written on the back. He was seen driving from the house in a white Chevrolet. Katie's bank card was also used after her death to withdraw cash, and witnesses saw a man who matched the same description in the area where the money was taken out. Timothy Hennis was quickly identified as the prime suspect in the murder, as he fit witness descriptions, and one witness even picked him out of a lineup. Timothy said he had no contact with Katie beyond picking up the dog, and claimed that he was at his in-laws the night of the murder, except for a short period when he stopped to refuel his car while returning home. Despite this, he was interviewed and asked to give saliva, hair, and fingerprint samples. Timothy's alibi fell apart when his former girlfriend came forward and said that he had visited her house that night, and evidence was found that he brought his members-only jacket to the dry cleaners on May 10th. He was also seen burning things in a bin by his neighbors. Timothy was arrested and charged with all three deaths. During his trial, Timothy was offered a plea deal, which he turned down. He was then found guilty on 3 counts of first-degree murder and sentenced to death. While waiting on death row, Timothy received an unsigned letter saying, "Dear Mr. Hennis, I did the crime. I murdered the Eastburns. Sorry you're due on the time. I'll be safely out of North Carolina when you read this." The same letter was also sent to the local sheriff's office. Based on the new evidence, Timothy appealed his sentence, which he was granted in 1988. marking the first time someone on death row in North Carolina had been granted a retrial. Timothy's lawyers argued that because police used graphic photos of the crime scene as part of his interrogation, the images had undue influence on him and swayed anything he said while being questioned. The new trial tore into the witnesses who claimed to have seen Timothy on the night of the murders. For one witness, his testimony was brought into question because he had described the weather as fair that night, when in fact it had been overcast. As well, another witness was challenged as she had originally said she didn't see Timothy near the bank when Katie's card was used, but altered her statement right before the trial. The only evidence seen to prove Timothy's guilt was his members-only jacket, but the defense proved that it had been tested and no traces of blood were ever found. In a shocking twist, Timothy went from waiting to be executed for the horrific crimes to being found not guilty of any of the charges. After the trial, Gary Eastburn took his only surviving daughter to England with him, where he eventually remarried. After his not guilty verdict, Timothy Hennis ended up re-enlisting in the Army and even was promoted to Staff Sergeant. He served in both Iraq and Somalia and was even part of Operation Desert Storm. When he retired from the Army, Timothy was a Master Sergeant. But the twists of this case do not end here. In 2005, Captain Larry Trotter was at a detective seminar which used the Eastburn murders as a case study to discuss the importance of credible evidence as it was still unsolved. While there, Trotter learned that DNA had been collected from a semen sample at the crime scene, but never tested because DNA technology was unreliable in the late 80s. Trotter decided to have the DNA tested, and in 2006, it was shockingly determined that it was undoubtedly from Timothy Hennis. Though Trotter appeared to have finally solved a decades-old case, there was one glaring problem: double jeopardy. The Fifth Amendment's double jeopardy clause states that because Timothy had been acquitted of the murders, he could not be retried for the same crime. It appeared that Timothy was going to get away with a triple homicide, and there was nothing the police could do about it. However, in the next twist of this case, the Army decided to take things into their own hands. In September of 2006, Timothy was recalled back into military duty and moved to Fort Bragg. There he was court-martialed, as the Uniform Code of Military Justice allows for members of the military who have previously been tried in civilian court to still be court-martialed. It was the only way around the clause of double jeopardy to have Timothy tried for his crimes. Timothy attempted to appeal, as he believed that the Army didn't have the jurisdiction, but was denied. In fact, he attempted to appeal on two other occasions. At his court-martial trial in 2010, the DNA evidence was finally given, along with the previous witness statements. Though Timothy's defense tried to claim that any relationship that had resulted in his DNA being found on Katie's body had been the result of consent, he was found unanimously guilty. One detective would later emphasize, "Tim Hennis is not a dumb man," and the fact that the man's score on an Army General Aptitude Test had placed him in the 97th percentile shows that he was indeed clever, almost clever enough to get away with murder. The same detective also recalled Timothy's biting sense of humor, explaining that after being charged with the crime, the man sneered at him. "Looks like I'm going to get to wear one of those little orange jumpsuits." Detective Robert Biddle described his take on Timothy's sinister motivations, saying, "Why do people rob banks? They think that others didn't know how to do it right. That was Tim Hennis's attitude. You can't get me. I'm smarter than you are." From 2010 to 2020, Timothy has attempted multiple appeals and calls for a second trial, all of which have been dismissed. He is once again on death row. The last case we have for you today may be the most shocking of them all. Carl Brandt was born in 1957 as the second child of two German immigrants living in Connecticut. Going by the nickname Charlie rather than Carl, his upbringing was typical and normal, though he was known to be shy. His family expanded to include two younger sisters and seemed to be utterly unextraordinary until Charlie was 13. During the night of January 3, 1971, Charlie retrieved his father's handgun from the drawer where everyone knew it was kept and proceeded to find his parents where they were both in the bathroom. His father was shaving, while his mother, who was 8 months pregnant with Charlie's newest sibling, was taking a bath. Charlie shot both of his parents, instantly killing his mother and her unborn baby, and severely wounding his father. Charlie then sought out his older sister, Angela, who he found in her bedroom. Though he attempted to shoot her too, the gun didn't fire because he had run out of bullets. Angela managed to fight Charlie off and ran outside, seeking help from the neighbors and to keep Charlie away from their two younger sisters who he hadn't harmed yet. Charlie chased after her, but when he came to the neighbor's house, he simply told them, "I just shot my mom and dad." When the police arrived, Angela described that her brother looked like he had been in a trance when he came into her room. It was determined that Charlie had been triggered to attempt to kill his entire family by a few factors, including pressure in school and the fact that days earlier, his father had shot and killed their family dog in front of him while they were out hunting. Though psychiatrists believed that mental illness also had to be a factor, they found no evidence of it in Charlie. Because he was only 13, Indiana law deemed he was too young to be tried for murder, and so after a brief 1 year at a psychiatric hospital, Charlie went back to his family, returned free to society. His younger sisters were never told that their brother had killed their mom, instead believing that she had died in a car accident, and no one spoke of what happened. To all, it appeared that Charlie's murderous incident had been a one-off, and he went on to have a normal life, even earning a degree in electronics in 1984. He landed himself a job at Ford Aerospace as a radar specialist and got married to Terry Helfrich in 1986. Allegedly, his sister Angela told him to tell Terry about the murder of their mother, but no one knows if he did or not. Some people suspect that Terry knew about what Charlie had done, but decided to ignore this troubling piece of his past. The couple moved to Pine Key, Florida, and appeared happy and in love, if almost inseparable. Charlie was described by all who knew him as a nice, easygoing, and quiet guy, and none would have guessed at his dark past as a child. But in September of 2004, the couple were forced to evacuate as Hurricane Ivan swept into the area. This proved to be a catalyst for the couple's downward spiral. Luckily, their niece, Michelle Jones, had a house near Orlando and offered them a place to stay with her to wait out the storm. Michelle had invited some friends to come over on September 13th, but she canceled after she and Charlie and Terry got into an alcohol-induced argument. For a few days after this phone call, no one could get in contact with Michelle, and her friends and mother began to worry. One of her close friends, Debbie Knight, decided to go and check up on Michelle herself on the 15th, and what she discovered was utterly shocking. The house was locked, and so to get inside, Debbie broke into the garage. Inside, she found Charlie's body. The body was decomposing and hanging from the rafters, where it appeared that he had taken his own life. Debbie didn't go any further and immediately called the police. Inside, police found Terry's body on the couch, stabbed 7 times. Michelle had been decapitated, with her head placed carefully next to her body, and her heart and organs removed. There were no signs of an intruder. police determined that it had once again been Charlie who murdered those around him. But this isn't the main twist of the case. After more investigation, the police uncovered that Charlie had a large collection of books, posters, and news clippings about surgery. Plus, his internet history showed that he frequently looked up videos of autopsies. But it was the practiced nature with which Michelle's body had been attacked and arranged that really alerted the police's attention. Evidence led police to believe that Charlie had experienced killing people more than he could have learned through just shooting his parents and through his obsession with autopsies. They started looking into cold cases in the area of Florida where he lived, but as Charlie traveled frequently for his job, they expanded the search to include all of Florida and the broader U.S. Police looked for any cases that seemed to fit the particular way that Charlie had arranged Michelle's body. Through the investigation, Charlie was first connected to the death of Sherry Parishaux. Sherry had been killed about 1,000 feet from his and Terry's home in 1989. Her heart had been removed, which became part of Charlie's M.O., and helped to connect him to the case. Allegedly, Terry had seen blood on Charlie on the night that Sherry died, and she had turned to her then-brother-in-law to say that she suspected something was amiss. Yet nothing ever came of her comments at the time. Charlie was then also found to be guilty of killing Darlene Toler in 1995, whose body was missing both her heart and her head. Her body had been found along a highway that Charlie used frequently. Both Sherry and Darlene's manner of deaths were described as surgical. But the case took another startling twist when Charlie's double life was exposed. He was connected to another 24 unsolved murders in Florida, some from as far back as 1973, which is the year he moved to the state. This year also means that Charlie started his career as a prolific serial killer at only 16. Though he hasn't been definitively found guilty of all 24 deaths, police believe that he is likely the culprit. It hasn't been ruled out that Charlie may have committed even more murders in Florida, as well as possibly in other areas where he lived previously. His case, along with the other cases we have discussed today, goes to show that you can't truly know a person, and that the people around you could be harboring dark secrets.